Hello, is this thing on? Are we live? It's happening, folks. We're podcasting now. Everybody's doing it. Why not us? I'm a little nervous, a little scared. Maybe we should just cancel it. It's not a good idea. We should just cancel it right now. Wait, you know what? No one's going to watch it anyway, so it doesn't matter. No, nobody's going to watch it. Do we as Americans have any idea how vulnerable we all are to a massive cyber attack?
If you have an internet exposed resource, it's going to get hit. It can get hit by anything. It takes a little bit of work and a trained eye to look at the kind of traffic and understand how much of it is automated and how much of it looks pointed. And how much of it is a person trying to look like an automated thing, or how much of it is an automated mechanism trying to look like a person? For the very reason of if it can happen on accident, it can happen on purpose. And we saw something that was ostensibly accidental. So what if that happens on purpose, right? And you don't always really take into account how much we rely on these communications until they're gone. Like you're inside a plane that MacGyver built and you're nervous as hell. like this whole plane is made of toothpicks and bubblegum. That's kind of how it felt going through with some of that stuff.
Welcome to the podcast. Our guest today is Mike Kernow, CEO of Defiant Networks. Welcome, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, man. It's good to be here.
A little bit about our background. We first met in, I think we decided it was 2016.
Yeah, I was working as a software integration engineer.
Yeah, I just remember that you had just grabbed the resume I was looking at, took my pen and paper, and you started writing code on it. And I was like, look at this. Like, this guy's legit. He's writing code live right here. I didn't even ask him, but he's trying to help me understand. I never forgot that. All right, so set the ground rules here. We have to donate $1 to charity every time we say, or you know. You don't. I will. But
this one's going to be me.
That's a goal of mine. I'm trying to whip myself out of doing that.
Maybe as the podcast goes on, just make it put like a counter in the corner.
Have an AI like listen in and calculate, like have a running tally. That's a great idea. Right. I wonder if MetaView can do that.
Skynet, help us out.
Right. So I'm going to attempt to do kind of an introduction for you, Mike, before we dive into any Q&A, really. Jamie, can you pull up Mike's LinkedIn for me? Yeah, we have a Jamie on this podcast. Jamie, pull it up. All right. Okay, there it is. All right. So Mike started in the U.S. Army Special Operations Command as a psychological operations specialist. This is back in 2009. After spending 6 years doing that, he came into the civilian world, started in web development, and that's where we met. Then he got into cybersecurity through several consulting firms. He was the lead SOC engineer for Trusted Metrics. He was the director of security services for SAM IT Solutions. He taught programming and cybersecurity for a few years at the Coder School. He was the CIO for RapidCat. For 3 years, solutions architect for Briar and Thorn Inc., product architect for Block Harbor Cybersecurity, CISO for Atomic Biometrics, and now chief executive officer for Defiant Networks. I believe that's your company, correct?
Yes.
All right.
It's actually getting pretty stuffy in here.
Oh, okay. All right. Look at the shirt. Okay. Plug away, my friend.
Dispense with the formality. Oh, God.
Okay. Okay. I love it. True showmanship already.
So it's official. Got the hat here, too. And I've got another hat here, too. Actually, that's
okay.
Kind of dark. But
do you sell merch on your website?
No, I think myself and my co-founder Kyle are the only two that actually have like the merchandise. So, but yeah, no, I am the CEO and co-founder of Defiant Networks. It is a software company that is trying to build the next generation of internet, the next layer of internet. We actually just had our fourth birthday. So yeah, we incorporated it back in 2020 before a lot of things happened. And we essentially have our own core proprietary suite of core networking protocols. And we've been using those to build out an actual overlay network for the internet itself. So like if we are right now doing this podcast and streaming over layer three internet, we're building a layer on top of that that looks and feels and operates similar to how the regular internet does, but has an unprecedented level of security and zero trust built into that network fabric. So when you're putting services on this network, you get, by default, without having to get anything else, zero trust networking communications and the infrastructure itself. We're doing a decentralized DNS mechanisms to kind of bypass a lot of the legacy stuff. There's a lot of chokeholds and cascading failure points in the regular internet as it is. So yeah, we're building this on the existing internet infrastructure, and we're building software products to actually facilitate a higher level of security for, like, right now, web applications and APIs. We're building a web application API gateway. It's essentially a firewall and gateway built in. These two things are separate, and we're just kind of putting them together, and we're using our networking protocols to build out that zero trust chain from edge all the way up to your resource. We used to call it transcendent networking, but I think we actually settled recently on multidimensional because we're adding that new layer on top of the typical layer three stuff.
Sounds interesting. Yeah, I had two questions. For those who don't know, and I of course know the answer to this. I mean, I know this, but can you explain what the term zero trust means?
Yeah, so zero trust, if you ask different people, you may get different answers. But when I say zero trust networking, I'm talking specifically about the networking protocols that facilitate the moving of bytes from A to B. But there's also other zero trust mechanisms that are a little bit more higher level on the OSI model, where you've got zero trust authentication and authorization and other mechanisms like that. But when I say zero trust networking, it's strictly zero trust on the networking components.
Yeah, and how does that relate to Web3? You hear this term Web3 thrown around. Is it different or part of that?
I feel like if you asked me this 2 years ago, I would have had a better answer. I think Web3 has a lot to do with utilization of blockchain technology baked into a lot of services. I don't know. It's kind of cool and it's kind of weird, this concept of decentralized identifiers to kind of break out of the standard DNS racket that regular layer three internet does. It's a way of doing some kind of decentralized DNS and naming of resources on layer three internet. So you can have Web3 components and network on the network we're building, because the communications will still work. I'm trying to think of how it exactly relates to it. It's not really built with the idea of implementing Web3 technology so much as just being a new playing field, right? Think of like the grid from Tron, how it's just a layer on the Tron system and they're building stuff on top of it. It depends if you watch the first Tron, the second Tron, whatever's in a
recent. Yeah, I love Tron.
I love it so much. Yeah, I just watched it probably for like 30th time with my oldest son a few weekends ago. So that was pretty cool.
Since you brought up sci-fi, we're talking about Tron. I just want to sidetrack the conversation and ask two quick questions. As you can see, I'm a Star Wars fan. What is your favorite Star Wars movie or show?
I've got a movie and I've got a show. Episode 3.
All right. Good choice.
I like 1 through 6. My second favorite's probably 1, Phantom Menace. But episode 3 was the first one I was actually old enough to go to the theaters with some friends and actually see when it came out. And I was the only guy dressed in Star Wars regalia. I had like a cloak. I had a lightsaber, and I was the only one. But I was so excited about it. You know, I think I was 8 or 9 or 10, maybe.
I'm a Rogue One and Andor fan. I can't wait for Andor season 2. Okay, second question. In your opinion, which is better, the movie Office Space, the show The Office, or the show Parks and Rec?
Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec. Okay, good, yeah.
The movie Office Space was pretty funny because it kind of the office space in the office, it's all like monotony of the office pretty much. And Parks and Rec was just really, really deep, a lot deeper than I thought. The office did too, but it took a while to get there. Yeah, Parks and Rec was really good. I don't know, just a really charming show. I marathoned it a lot before it went over to Peacock. I used to watch it all the time on Netflix. And then they sold out to Peacock. Peacock. It's such a weird name. I don't like that. I don't know if I like it.
Yeah, that. I don't either. I don't have.
You can go watch Parks and Rec, like a few episodes for free, but it's like, okay, when I watch the rest, you got to pay us. And like,
you can get all the Ron Swanson you need on YouTube. There's like clip compilations.
I used to have the Swanson Pyramid of Greatness hanging on my wall. I don't know what I did, but as soon as I find it, I'll pay. There's still a few boxes in the garage I haven't checked.
Oh, it's somewhere in there. You got to dig it up.
I didn't toss it. I know I didn't toss it because that's been up in my wall for years.
Yeah, I also like the UK version of The Office, one with Ricky Gervais. He cracks me up.
I almost forgot about that one. Yeah, that was I only saw a little bit of it, though. I never got quite hooked in it. The same way that I never got The Office in the beginning. I started seriously watching The Office when Will Ferrell came on for like three episodes or whatever. And that was hilarious.
I missed that. I did not know that he did that. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it was just like three. It was just three episodes, but it was really funny.
Jamie, find those and send them to me. All right. So we're going to kick off some of the questions here, the serious questions. Current state of affairs. Do we as Americans have any idea how vulnerable we all are to a massive cyber attack?
We've got a better idea, but I don't think it's really the whole picture yet. However, there have been good steps in the right direction. I think it's still a metric, like, shit ton of work to be done. Back in 2019, when I started talking about industrial control system cybersecurity, that this idea of bridging the air gap, or I'm going to cringe when I say this, but IT-OT convergence, it's basically like taking oil and water and just going, meh, you know, taking these systems that are responsible for physical actuation and machinery that has real effect in the physical world, and then combining that with IT systems and trying to make the whole playing field this flat thing, which is not, it's not very good in my opinion. Back in 2019, I used to talk about this, and I would share statistics that I would get from certain things like Modbus devices and Siemens PLCs and stuff that you can find on the open internet for some reason. And I believe it was about 13,000 devices nationwide. And now it's like, it may even be over 20,000 now. There's a lot more stuff that's come to light though, actually, which is kind of a good thing in a strange backwards way. Like back in, I believe it was 2020 or 2021 when the Oldsmar water treatment facility was hacked, like where Clearwater and all that stuff is out by the Western Panhandle side. This place that you never even hear of has their water treatment facility hacked because of some leaked tools on TeamViewer that were never changed, I think was the story. There are a lot of very creative people out there with either a lot of time and or a lot of money, depending on who's backing them. We still don't really have a full picture. You've got nation state actors, APT groups that are state funded. There's even an APT group from Vietnam that back in 2020 was trying to conduct exploits on other automotive OEMs that competed with their nation's OEM called VinFast, which is an automaker from Vietnam. Apparently, I hear they make good stuff. I've never driven a VinFast car before. There's that. There's supply chain issues. So you get equipment from countries that we're not exactly on good terms with right now that proliferate through our nation's infrastructure ecosystem. So like, for example, if you've got a bunch of devices made in a specific country that are now part of an already implemented industrial site, could be traffic control equipment, could be factory machinery, could be substation equipment. There's a lot of ideas and thoughts of backdoors and those things, and you've got to be able to figure out what products are safe and what products aren't. There's a lot of things that's come to light. I think the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, does a lot of really good work on trying to educate people and inform on attacks and alerts and getting that information out and helping. CISA is a really great place too if you like responsibly disclose vulnerabilities that you find in the field. They'll work with you to responsibly disclose that and act as an intermediary with the vendor of the device that you find the vulnerability with and set the stage so that you can work with the vendors with their oversight and all that. That's pretty cool. Do we know how vulnerable we are? I don't really think so. I think we have an idea. and we go, okay, we think we're here, but there's all this other stuff that we still don't know. So we know what we know, and I think we have a great idea of knowing what we don't know. I think we know the rough edges of the thing that we don't know, if that makes sense.
Got it. Did you see the movie on Netflix, Leave the World Behind? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I walked in when my wife was watching it. I had gone off of work. I'm like, what the hell is this? Why are there Teslas crashing into each other? What's going on?
Okay.
And I know it's a movie about seemingly a large cyber attack just knocked out a bunch of infrastructure. And I'm not going to watch the whole thing. Can you tell me what the main cause of it was? Was it like some big satellite attack or some shit?
Yes. The whole premise of the movie is you never really find out what the culprit is. I mean, there's rumors. This country, that country, and then there's this moment where one of the main characters describes like a plan to take down the United States. And the movie scared me. I did some prepping, buying freeze-dried meals, water filtration systems, extra water, extra like survival gear. I spent some money after seeing that movie because I was like, this is gonna happen. And what's funny is in the beginning of the movie, what you see is a solar eclipse. I think it's a lunar eclipse, I think it is. But the moon is blocked out because the sun is directly behind the earth. And the movie starts with that. So there's a lot of speculation online about how that could be an indication of when it will happen. And there's supposed to be two lunar eclipses this year. I can't think of the dates now. I think, Jamie, you got to pull this up, please. I love saying that. But then there's another one in September. Somebody clipped out a section of the movie where the daughter finds a really elaborate basement that is in a very wealthy home. And the whole basement's like stocked up with food and, you know, everything you could ever want for the end of the world, right? And somebody zoomed in on the computer that's in that room. And there was a date in September that correlates with the lunar eclipse. That's going to happen in September. That really got my wheel spinning. Like, okay. So if you're going to prepare, then you probably should do it before that date.
It kind of sounds like prophetic, but in like a manufactured way because it's a Hollywood production. But the interesting piece of that is from the very little bit that I've seen and all the other stuff I read after its release, it gives you a kind of glimpse of what happens when communication systems are knocked out. And very recently, I want to say in the past 2 weeks, we had that big AT&T outage that was like a day and a half or so. Or it depended on where you were, I guess. Like for me, it was like more than half a day. It was most of the workday pretty much. And it wasn't just AT&T, there was also some Verizon, I think, too. And AT&T was very clear to say, oh, don't worry, this wasn't a cyber attack. What if you weren't thinking that? And now you're just like, oh, okay, well, shit, maybe it was.
Now it's got to be.
Apparently, and this is just hearsay, but apparently some insiders that work at AT&T were saying that there was a large software or tool update that messed up. They were updating something with their network, something with the back-end network. Not the radio access network, the towers and whatnot, but I think it was some piece of back-end software that was being done. I could be wrong. All I know is it seemed to be because of an update, right? Accidental. But the outcome is essentially the same if you did knock out communication infrastructure for cell providers. I worked a lot with cyber-physical systems and operational technology, where typically cybersecurity for that kind of stuff can often get lumped into the IT umbrella. But I'm a huge proponent of putting cybersecurity in with the safety umbrella of whatever project that is, whatever agency you're working with, for the very reason of if it can happen on accident, it can happen on purpose. And we saw something that was ostensibly accidental. So what if that happens on purpose, right? We see that, and then we start to see things like Facebook and Instagram and some other social medias just went down the past week, I think. And you don't always really take into account how much we rely on these communications until they're gone. I think we have a lot of work to do on the resilience side.
Yeah, I was listening to another podcast, PBD, with Eric Prince was on there, and he was thinking that it was definitely a cyber attack. They're testing the waters. The Blackwater guy. Yeah, he sold the company, but he's got his own podcast now. Oh, and by the way, Eric, if you're listening, you need to watch the Leave the World Behind movie and make your own podcast about your thoughts about that movie. We're going to have to tag Jamie. Can you email him, please? Email his group, if you don't mind. when you look at the volume of hacks, or at least the attempts coming in, like, what does that volume look like? Is it just a constant barrage, or is it a random waves of attempts, or is it just like constant bombardment at all times?
Both. It kind of depends. So a while ago, when I was at a different firm, I led the vulnerability management program and the security operations center for a rather large automotive OEM. The main thing that we monitored was this connected vehicle diagnostic system, which was globally deployed. It's essentially a mechanism that you've got an OBD2 port device that you plug into the vehicle, and the technicians can essentially connect to the vehicle with the internet, with a cloud-hosted platform that they, you know, built and designed to run the vehicle through a battery of tests, essentially. And you get a lot of drive-by attacks where every now and again you see that some of maybe the login page or some of the resources that are internet connected just get, you know, of just trying to test and try and do things like get banner grabbed and see, is this PHP, is this Microsoft, is this Java web page or something. If you have an internet exposed resource, it's going to get hit. It can get hit by anything. It takes a little bit of work and a trained eye to look at the kind of traffic and understand how much of it is automated and how much of it looks pointed, and how much of it is a person trying to look like an automated thing, or how much of it is an automated mechanism trying to look like a person. So it's kind of this game of trying to map out what people are doing, figuring out what's going on. But, you know, first and foremost, you got to make sure that you have your protections in place. Make sure you have your security playbooks and how to respond if something does happen.
Yeah, what are some of your favorite tools that you use to defend networks?
My go-to CM tool right now, it's OpenSearch, which OpenSearch is CM, or Security Information Event Management. I call it Security Incident Event Management because I'm not pedantic and I think that sounds better. I use OpenSearch, which is an Apache 2 fork. It's an AWS built tool, but it's completely free and open source, and it was forked from Elasticsearch, which Elasticsearch is a flat file indexing system that is, in my opinion, much superior to other kinds of databases for storing events. I like using OpenSearch for the CM. Notice I didn't say Splunk.
Yeah, I was about to say, it sounds like free Splunk.
Yes, you can make Elasticsearch and OpenSearch, you can have feature parity among the two. And I think the open source, OpenSearch and Elasticsearch are much better to use because for one, it's free. Two, you have complete control. Even when you have Splunk, you can get the cloud hosted service or you can host it yourself, and you still have to do a lot of tooling and maintenance. And it's like, having worked with Splunk in the past, and this is not, I don't have anything against the organization, I just don't like that specific tool. Years back, having worked on the back end of Splunk to try and fix things, there are certain things that felt very MacGyver-y, like you're inside a plane that MacGyver built and you're nervous as hell. like, this whole plane is made of toothpicks and bubblegum. That's kind of how it felt going through with some of that stuff in Splunk. That's just me. I know people that like it. I know people that don't. I'm one of the ones that don't. But, I mean, there's always room for redemption to get better. I think one of the most important things in security operations when you're monitoring and protecting, and you have to record and respond to stuff, is a SOAR system, Security Orchestration Automated Response Tool. It's essentially a way of automating workflows, and typically you see a SOAR platform that would be deployed to automate your security playbooks. So if you get a certain kind of event that looks a certain way that you've predefined, it can fire off a gajillion other events that maybe enrich XYZ to get you something else to help you. Or it can be, hey, we've detected this like really high level threat in our SIEM, and we've got a collection of people that we got to notify, email, page, and smoke signal. You can have a SOAR platform do that. I used to like this tool called Phantom. It was a free tool, but then Splunk bought it and it became shit. So all I remember is I was heartbroken because I was in charge of determining what the best SOAR tool to use in the Security Operations Center to integrate with Splunk. And I've known about Phantom for a while, and they got bought out, and then it's like, oh, we have to pay for it. I'm like, man, okay, I didn't think we're going to have to pay $1 gajillion for this. And so I found this thing called Shuffle, which is a free and open source SOAR mechanism. You can just go to, you know, Google, type in GitHub space Shuffle, and you'll see the repository right there that you can set up yourself for free. And it's got a bunch of hooks into a bunch of different kinds of platforms you would need to, like, you know, hey, if the SOAR detection mechanism gets this kind of event fed to it, it can fire off an Outlook update and some SharePoint spreadsheet somewhere, and then also make a Jira event or something.
Now, how does that compare to an EDR tool? Would it replace it or work alongside it?
It would work with it. Yeah, I mean, EDR, those are the mechanisms that go on the edge devices themselves, or the endpoints here. So, like, my computer would have some kind of mechanism to look for a network and host intrusion events and report that up the chain. I mean, it would work with it. Yeah.
Okay.
EDR is it's just the endpoint detection response system, the whole mechanism of putting things on the endpoint devices themselves. It's just extending the tendrils of monitoring and management down to the device level itself, instead of just going off of something like network logs or some other kind of abstracted mechanism to determine some kind of breach.
Very cool. Well, yeah, I'm surprised I haven't really seen this term SOAR on job descriptions yet, but I have a feeling that I will soon. I'm just Googling it here, and IBM has a QRadar. That's the top hit on Google. And then you got ReliaQuest, and then Palo Alto. Just quick opinion question here. In terms of firewalls, are you a Palo Alto fan or Cisco, or what do you prefer?
That's a good question. I have more of a liking towards Palo Alto, just because I had worked with it a lot and I got more used to it.
I got a friend that works there, and he speaks pretty highly of it. They stole him from Cisco too. So they call it going to the dark side, leaving Cisco for Palo Alto.
Does it happen so much there's a name for it?
Apparently. Yeah. Maybe I'll have to invite him. I won't say his name yet, but he's podcasted before. He might be willing to come on. I wanted to give you a chance to chat about the thing that you built. You have created a programming language called Hachi, and I was just curious, what made you decide to build that, and what are the benefits to using it in case other people are interested?
Yeah, sure. So at Defiant, a lot of our stuff is built in C and C++ for the underlying core implementations of our networking protocols. And there was an idea of trying to actually merge some things together. Trying to figure out what that looked like was actually kind of difficult. And I came to the conclusion that I wanted to have some kind of control layer that would interface with three C or C++ code bases and repositories that I can kind of try and merge together and compile jointly. And I wanted to do that. And then I was also thinking about, man, I really don't like writing C++ code or C. I love what you can do with it. They're amazing languages that are super powerful. You can do anything in it. They're extremely powerful and very, very historic, and it's everywhere. But I don't like writing in it. It just kind of like sucks. It's not that fun. And so I also wanted to have a way of writing C++ kind of stuff that was a bit more automated or abstracted. Eventually that just ended up turning into a programming language, because the whole idea was it was a tool. I was creating a tool for a specific need that I had. And much like Python, it's kind of a successor of this old language called ABC, which went defunct when Guido Van Rossum, he liked it and a lot of things from it. So he brought so many of those concepts over to Python. We started writing it in the early 90s, I think. I think he actually started in 1990. I had found something similar. I found this language that was built on C++, and I thought it was really cool. It was called Pinecone. It was only around for like a year. And so I spent a long time looking through the code base and figuring out exactly how it worked. And I remember thinking, because I had started, you know, working on it for some POC stuff, and it just was at a point where I could tell there are a lot of things about it that I like. And I took a lot of that, like I took mechanisms for implementing C++ code and being able to drag and drop it right into your file. I thought that was awesome. And so I took a lot of these things that I liked from Pinecone and brought them over into Hachi, which is kind of a successor to that in a way. So the idea is I wanted a language that it was a bit lower level than Python that would allow me to compile fast machine code. Because I came to the conclusion as well that not just with these, you know, different C and C++ code bases I wanted to do some, like, you know, merging in Frankenstein type shit with. I also wanted something that I could use and build to my exact needs. And I was thinking about looking into Go for some other use cases that I was using Python for, but grew to need more speed requirements. Performance requirements. And it just became this thing that I just kept building on. And now it's a programming language that you can download, install, run. To give the definition, it is a type safe, memory safe. That's a big important thing. It implements its own auto free when it transpiles. Type safe, memory safe, compiled language. I just released the version 0.1.3 last week where I made some updates. I implemented a way of compiling that would detect if there is any kind of memory leaks. So like even if Hachi itself is memory safe and it implements its own auto free, but you can also drag and drop and just plop in C++ code or C code into the file itself, that can be unsafe. That's kind of on the onus of the developers. So you can compile it in a mode that will give you all of the tech and memory leaks that's there. So you can go back and fix it, or even determine, like, hey, this is a non-issue. It's just the way that the compiler is seeing, and it could be a non-issue. But
very cool.
Yeah, so I released it October 23rd, or October 27th, I think it was the 23rd, on GitLab. And then I just, I built a documentation site. Cause I work on so much stuff that it's a lot of proprietary stuff. I can't just put it out there. Hachi was the one thing that, as I built it, I guess I kind of wanted it to be out there to be like, hey, here's something I'm actually building in public of all my years of experience. I don't do a lot of open source stuff, and here's finally something I'm working on. Two, it's not, if I'm the only person that ends up using it, I'm happy either way because I built it for myself. But if other people can get their hands on it and play with it, that would be cool too. Pretty much anytime that I find myself needing to do something specific or thinking that I might do something specific, I will either build it into the language or I will build it as a core module that you can import into your file. What I like to think about it is, imagine something that's a little bit between Python and Go that you can compile and is flexible and I think is fun to write in. So
yeah, we'll put a link to it in the show notes, or we'll make sure it's able to be found. So it's funny that you were mentioning disliking writing C++ code. I was looking back as you were talking and trying to research, because I saw someone I follow on LinkedIn reshared an article from infoworld.com, and I don't know a thing about them, but the article says the White House urges developers to dump C and C++ and embrace memory-safe programming languages. The NSA specifically calls out C#, Go, Java, Ruby, Rust, and Swift as memory-safe. So hearing you talk about Hachi being memory-safe, right? Maybe you were, in essence, trying to solve that problem.
I didn't want to have to go back and free all the memory allocations that I would have to make. That was it.
Okay, you just made it out of laziness. That's all it is. That's how most things are made.
It's also this thing too, like, I didn't really want a language that I was involved with to have any kind of like inherent memory leaks from the get-go. So there's a lot of language too that have memory safety mechanisms, like bound checking and garbage collection, and I think Rust has a borrow system, which is actually, it's a relatively new way of doing it, which is kind of cool, of doing memory safety. I think I give C and C++ a pass because C and C++ have, like, the reason, okay, so you said Python was on that list, right? Wasn't it on that
Python's list? Is surprisingly not on the list.
Yeah, oh, okay, that's interesting. The Python, the implementation of Python is built in C. It's officially called C Python. That's the implementation that, like, you and I would use if we're doing something. the idea with that is that you're not really coding in C, you're coding in this abstract language, which is interpreted with the C compiler, and then it's compiled into bytecode, whereas if you're just writing pure C and compiling that, you compile it to machine code. I'm surprised Python is not on there, though. Many languages, except for maybe Zig, I think, maybe Nim, I don't know, there's a lot of really cool lower-level compiled languages that are coming out. V also implements its own auto-free mechanism, which is kind of cool. It's an interesting thing, because I had heard a talk by Jen Easterly, who's the director of CISA, and I was hearing her talk about memory safety in programming languages. The direction that I had thought I heard her talk about, and others too, was that do not use C and C++. And I remember taking issue with this because you should know what a memory unsafe language is before you work in a memory safe language. You should know the kinds of things and pitfalls to look out for. You should know all the kinds of foot guns that exist out there to shoot yourself in the foot, you know, work around it and mitigate those things. So when you're working in a memory safe language, you never get that exposure to what that can be. Granted, I don't think that's like a case for like you should never use memory safe languages. I just think when you're saying that, a lot of organizations will take that to heart. Picking a software language for something is extremely case-dependent. It's hard to make just like a big sweeping statement like that and then have it stick. But it's not entirely wrong. I thought it was funny because people that support Rust are called Rustations because their logo is like a crab. We're seeing videos of people calling, they're like, oh my God, the White House is full of Rustations. I'm like, yeah, that's, I don't know if that's the case, but at least it's funny.
Yeah, I see Rust on a lot of job description wish lists, but we don't see it too much out there on resumes yet. So I bet it's going to change. It'll slowly increase in popularity. So next question here, what are your go-to sources of information to stay up to speed in the cyber world? And this could be websites, podcasts. What are you listening to?
I do some listening, but mostly reading. The things that I listen to a lot of things that are a bit, like, unofficial. They're just, like, individuals that are, you know, pretty smart, and they have a lot of know-how, like, technical know-how. For privacy stuff, I listen to Surveillance Report. It used to be a podcast from TechLore, TechLore, but now Surveillance Report has bifurcated into its own channel, which is pretty cool. A lot of privacy stuff and security stuff affect large organizations or like novel attacks that come out. I listen to Some Ordinary Gamers. Talks a lot about a lot of different things, but he's able to take what are otherwise kind of complex topics when it comes to security. He talks everything from movies to gaming and whatnot, but he's also like, he works in the tech world, so he knows a lot about computer security and privacy. Also, Mental Outlaw. There's like the top three that I listen to for cybersecurity. I don't listen to like much like official podcasts. Every now and again, I might watch a Black Hat or DEF CON talk, but I typically just listen to those guys over that. And then for reading, LinkedIn can be good, predicated on you following the right people that, you know, post that kind of information. Twitter can be good. I don't really do much social media, but when I was using Twitter, I would follow a lot of key industry voices or whatever, and most often they're just parroting something that another person found, and it's like a whole ecosystem of like resharing, which is fine. I don't take issue with that, but you find a few people that post good information. I also like the websites bleepingcomputer.com and The Hacker News, not to be confused with Hacker News, because Hacker News is a Y Combinator thing. And The Hacker News is a website very similar to Bleeping Computer. They often have parity with one another, but if I'm looking for something specific, or, you know, one might have it before the other, whatever.
What I like about your list so far is that I have not heard of any of them. So I'm going to have to check them out.
It's good information for me. So hopefully it helps somebody else too. And CISA is the main authoritative source that I do listen to. Like I've worked with CISA to disclose vulnerabilities before, and I like most everything they do, and they have a really good mechanism for alerting people on product vulnerabilities and whatnot.
Those are some good sources. I'm going to have to bookmark some of those when I re-listen to it. Hey, we'll change over to a different style of questions here. I interact with quite a few CISOs, and a lot of times, you know, you just feel the weight of their job on their shoulders, right? The weight of having the responsibility of preventing a breach at their company. What ways do you find that you can deal with the stress of the job?
This is all going to be dependent on a lot of factors, but if I'm speaking just very generally, you can be like the most spot on, buttoned up, have all your shit together, professional, and then one bad thing can happen. One breach. What one small phishing email that, you know, maybe hits just one person, but it still got allowed in. Dealing with negativity bias is a huge thing because the human mind doesn't value a positive thing of one value and a negative thing of equal value the same. You can be doing so many good things, but then it just takes one bad thing, even if it's small, to bring it down. I think that is a very... Again, if I'm speaking very generally here, I think that is a big source of it, because you can have all your stuff together. You're doing all the right things, but something novel happens and you're not prepared for it. Like a zero day happens. It still doesn't look good on you in general if you're the information security officer. I think coming to the realization that you can only do the best that you can do at any given time, and you can't really do more than that. As long as you're still working to grow and be better, alerting more, the best way I can describe it is if I'm running late for something, and if I'm already late, I don't speed. I don't speed. I just drive normally. I take my time. Like, I'm already late.
No need to make it worse, right?
Yes. And I think that kind of stuff contributes to burnout a lot as well. Like, you're constantly trying to... Being better than you already are is a fine thing, like striving for excellence. But there's also this realization that you need to hit that if something happens and you know that you've done your best, it's like, well, I've done all the right things. I don't know what more I can do than that. Now I know this novel thing can happen, or whatever it is. I mean, it will suck if you're completely unprepared for, like, something simple like, you know, SQL injection on an e-commerce store or something. I had a different scenario happen, and this isn't really to my credit in general, but just a general statement. It's only been one actual, like, no-shit breach that's ever happened on my watch that was due to something so protracted and far removed from me, it may as well almost not exist. But it happened where someone basically pirated a piece of equipment. Wasn't prepared for that. None of us were. The client wasn't. I wasn't. Our team wasn't. It was an outlier. Nothing really came of it because we caught it in time. But yeah, I mean, I was in charge of the SOC at the time. If that turned into something, they would have been on me. And my answer would have been, hey, we're doing all the stuff we're supposed to be doing. And
right.
Now we know. Now we know this happens. Dealing with stress, just understanding that you can only do the best that you can do at that point. And the best that you can do is like an ever-changing goalpost that you push to become better. Getting someone to come to that realization, when you're living in a world that's full of just like shit KPIs and security scores, and you're trying to collate and aggregate and simplify everything that you do to a set of numbers that you give to people to report to execs, that's where that kind of stuff can get hard. Because you're measuring your mean time to detect, your mean time to respond, remediate. And you can have a really good, you know, metrics of your performance, of your security team, but then all of a sudden, one bad thing happens, and that f***s up your average, and that becomes something that you got to work back up to. And if you're just someone that's looking at numbers, it's not going to look good. There's a lot of context around that stuff. So as far as how to really deal with the stress, I don't know how to really deal with it, but I think it's coming to the mentality where you don't get stressed out about it.
At peace with it. Yeah, it's just got to be hard knowing that you might be doing everything that you possibly know to do to defend. But even if you're doing everything, you're still only 90% covered. You're still that 10% there where something bad can happen. You can get a breach. It's just kind of how it is. So it's just got to be tough knowing that if something does happen, you get a breach. Everybody's pointing the finger at you.
You've got the target on your back and your chest, right. And your forehead. And just hope no one ever hits that, you know?
Right, yeah. In recruiting, there's a saying called, you're only as good as your last placement, I guess, as a CISO. You're only as good as your last breach. All right, so just in general, when you're in the profession, what irritates you the most about this job?
I think for one, like a short answer, is the amount of people that work in cybersecurity, but like haven't written code before or like understand how certain systems work. Because I've seen a lot of people that come in and they know the best practice and they know the NIST framework pretty well. And that's all good and fine. But I've always felt that someone that comes from the security engineering background or systems development or system design that comes into cybersecurity is always, it's a very small potatoes thing that aggravates me. That's a personal thing. Like, that doesn't mean you're bad at your job. I just, you know, I feel like I'm speaking a foreign language sometimes if I have to talk about this stuff to be. The second thing, organizations that tend to see cybersecurity as an after thing, a thing to do after, and don't integrate security into the thing you're doing. And when you try and convince people to integrate security into the thing you're doing, it just kind of looks like you're trying to, you know, milk something from that in a sense. It's like, oh, you just want to get in early. It's like, no, I want to not have to do work in the future on this, all this shit that was totally preventable. Communicational gap between cybersecurity and business. I've seen it happen a few times. I'm certain it happens a lot more than I've seen, but from the times that I've dealt with it and seen it, the communicational gap between cybersecurity and business, it doesn't always seem to work together. So like, cybersecurity is not really the main player when it comes to what a company's goals are. If there's a business decision to be made that actually introduces vulnerabilities and risks, it's your job as a cybersecurity leader to make sure that everyone else knows, hey, this is the risk. Do you want to eat it? Right? And if they say yes, well, then, hey, put all the supplemental controls in place you can. If not, then awesome. We'll work with you to figure that out. I feel like that's kind of a new business cultural thing that's happening where that's getting better. But like I said before with one of the other questions, it's still a lot of work to be done.
I think a lot of people will agree with you. And it's not just in cybersecurity. Those words can be spoken of people in the UX department. You know, everybody wants to get in on the decisions earlier on to prevent bad things from happening that they have to deal with in the future. A lot of talk of AI. We can't have a podcast without mentioning AI. Are you excited about AI, or do you just get like more concerned?
I'm also going to say both. It's multifaceted, right? So, okay. I use AI a lot in trying to figure out very pointed, specific programming issues I have. I think it can contribute to skills gap issues going forward. I think it's going to help senior people grow more and exponentially increase their growth and knowledge and productivity curves. And I think it's going to keep junior people more junior and have them do this more like that. But the idea is, like, when I use generative AI and LLMs for anything, I typically already know exactly what I have to do. I'm like, man, I cannot figure this one thing out. Do I have some trailing semicolon somewhere? I've controlled F 13 million times. I can't find the thing. What's wrong with it? So using it for simple tasks to just extend myself a little bit further, I think that's really good. The kind of bad side of it, I think, has to deal with how it's used. When I was in PSYOP, one thing I learned is that if you have control over all the chokeholds and egress points of information, how that all gets disseminated, you can write the narrative for anything. That's why, you know, Google's been accused of that kind of stuff. Any big tech search engine type company, even like journalist websites, get accused of that stuff too. It's like, that's not what happened. This is false information, etc. I think mechanisms of misinformation bias will always be a part of AI. The way that people use AI now as a search engine is just an extended use case of how they already use Google. And I think, I don't like using the term misinformation. I'll say false information, because I feel like misinformation is a dog whistle for stuff. I think that if extended use of AI to kind of be this evolved search engine will inevitably make it much easier to make people think certain things, because for one, that information, you don't always know where it's coming from. Unless if you're using U-Bots from U.com, they actually cite all their sources. It's pretty cool. They also have a good privacy policy as well. I just don't have them integrated into my IDE yet. I don't know if that's a thing they do. But it's not just that, but the part is you'll be interacting with it so much, it'll know how to present that information to you on an individual level. The AI will eventually learn how to talk to you so well that it can present completely crazy stuff, but in a way that you process very quickly. And it'll know what kind of cues and what kind of subtleties to inject in things. And so it's like, who owns these AIs? Well, it's not you, it's not your family, it's an organization. And that organization gets money from somewhere, and the people that it gets that money from have their own things they want to do. And I think it will make people lazy, because those of us like me and you, I think, can make a really good use of AI, because it's not a crutch, it's a tool, it's a screwdriver. But I think as people get older or newer generations come up, they're going to see that screwdriver and say, oh, crutch. I'm trying to keep my kids away from working in technology. Makes me want to keep my kids away from technology. Even like TV shows now, I try and get them. I just started watching Power Rangers with my oldest. I'm like, okay, you can watch TV stuff when you're older, but watch this first. Let the YouTube algorithm take over. I actually have a lot of screenshots of like some really insidious stuff. If you're not signed in on YouTube and you just watch a bunch of kids' videos, you start getting weird ads.
Oh, I know. I've seen it with my daughter. I mean, it's normally what you hear too. You'll just be cleaning or something. She's sitting there watching the tablet and just start hearing things. They're like, wait a minute, what are you watching? And you look over and it's like, people in strange outfits, strange haircuts, doing complete nonsense. And I'm like, all right, you got to give me this thing. Let's change the channel. Because I'm pretty convinced that your phone is watching you and the tablets are watching you. Because I can be on YouTube and I can be watching something and laying on the couch, laying in the bed. And then my daughter will come up and grab my phone. And when she starts swiping, it knows that it's a child looking at my phone now. And it'll feed it different videos in the feed. I'm pretty sure the phone is looking at your facial features and knows when something makes you happy, sad, concerned, if it's an adult, male, female, child. I think it knows. It's crazy.
I got you. Yeah, there's a few things at play there. For one, I don't know, I'm not saying you're wrong at all. I don't know if it's about facial features and if it knows it's a kid or a parent watching. I think it knows what times of day and what use patterns precipitates the longest amount of engagement. And engagement, keeping you in, is the core purpose of these algorithms. So if it's your kid watching YouTube, you know, kids stuff on there, it's going to know it's a kid. And it's going to say, hey, this kid likes this thing because it's been on, you know, she's been on here for a while. But there's also this thing called ultrasonic cross-device tracking, where your smart devices emit ultrasonic, you know, beeps and boops and bops every now and again, that if you got Facebook on your phone or something that and you have it active in the background or some other social media, it can hear these little dog whistle type things. I'm watching Star Trek on Netflix or something, and the smart TV does a little thing. Then my phone gets a little thing. I don't have social media on here. This is a custom operating system, so I don't have all that shit on here. But if I did, then my phone, if I had Facebook running in the background, Facebook goes, oh, you like Star Trek? Okay, cool. Here's a bunch of Star Trek stores and stuff. It's free market, man. Like, if they decide that's what they want, I'm going to disagree with you, but I support your choice, even if I don't like it.
They're all just making money off of ads. They want to feed you ads. You know, everybody's concerned about different companies having their data, right? I mean, I'm like, okay, take my data. I mean, what are you going to find out? I sit in my house a lot, in my office, and I go to Food Lion every once in a while. Every once in a while, I go to lunch. Wow, this is...
We may be the same person, actually.
Game-changing data here.
Yeah, I think the big thing about that data, though, is privacy is not always just a thing that you protect, but it's what protects you and your other rights, obviously, right? So something that you do today can make you a criminal tomorrow. There's not always a lot of topical contemporary examples that I can think of off the top of my head. except for if you're a firearms enthusiast and you had a bump stock. There was a legislation passed, I want to say it was like some innocuous time, that like overnight you became a criminal for having.
Right, right. I remember that. I do not own any bump stocks, by the way. Lost them all in a boating accident.
Something that you do or say or think today can make you a criminal tomorrow. And even if I myself don't think I do anything crazy, I'm also in cybersecurity, and I also develop software, and I also search a lot of weird shit because I'm trying to solve weird problems. I also don't use Google for searching anymore. I use Brave. I try to stay away from things that I know are going to track me. I don't even use YouTube. I use NewPipe, which is a free and open source YouTube client that doesn't have ads.
Oh.
A lot of people don't know this. If you dig in, if you dig into the front end code enough, you can just get the YouTube video. And so you have a client like NewPipe that you can bypass all the ads and all the other
things. Interesting.
It just presents YouTube to you as if you're a user without an account, and it just,
right,
you know, just like that. And then, you know, you just go from there.
Interesting. Yeah, it makes sense that you would have that as a cybersecurity guy. I'm going to wrap up and let you get back to your day here. I just wanted to help out some of the folks that might be listening early in career, maybe fresh graduates that, you know, are interested in cybersecurity. They want to get into cybersecurity, or maybe they're in a different skill set altogether and want to transition into cybersecurity. What advice would you give those people who are trying to break in? Like, what are just like the first three steps you would take to make yourself more desirable for an employer?
If you're trying to break in, maybe avoid the front door. So when I came into cybersecurity, there wasn't always really like a clear path. I kind of found my own way in by creating a cybersecurity-based LLC with absolutely zero experience. And then I spent a year just like studying almost all my free time, and then actually ended up getting some pen tests with that same firm with some software companies in North Carolina here. That's like a very roundabout way to do it. It's very hard, but it was a lot of risk involved with that, and it ended up paying off. But my aperture doesn't cover the entire scope of the cybersecurity market, but I do know it's hard coming in fresh because of economic concerns and constraints organizations are dealing with right now, and how risk averse cybersecurity and technology hiring seems to be at the moment. And the fact that it's seemingly companies, at least from sources I know that run software companies, work at software companies, tell me that organizations are like really sitting on their wallet, you know, they're not taking it out.
Right.
I think
definitely feeling that
really, really, really helps to find ways to circumvent risk aversion. If you know someone, it's not always what, okay, all right, insert the cliche advice here. It's not what you know, it's who you know.
But correction, it's not who you know, it's who knows you.
That's actually really good. That's true, yeah, because I mean, I've had people talk to me that knew me before I knew them. That's very true. It's who knows you. But whoever knows you should know that you know your stuff in some way, and that you should be able to add value wherever you are. The usual advice I would see on like LinkedIn and stuff is like, hey, work as a support desk and try and move your way around to stuff. I don't really know how realistic that is anymore, because then the barrier of entry to getting that help desk job to pivot to cybersecurity, you can do it very simply, I think. Make sure that you have a basic grasp of the fundamentals, but that you know those fundamentals really well. Have a good idea of where you want to start, because cybersecurity is much more than just like red team hacking and blue team defending. That's like some weird gamification shit that someone made up after they watched too much Rooster Teeth, Red versus Blue or something. If you're new, Google cybersecurity domain map. There is a guy named Henry Jiang. He has different versions of the cybersecurity domain map, which is like really good. I've never seen anything better than it at all.
It's Jamie, can you pull that up?
Huge mind map of cybersecurity domains. The most recent version is from 2021. It's version 3.1. And I think you really need to look at that to get an idea, because I've met a lot of people that are trying to get into cybersecurity, and they say, hey, I want to get into cybersecurity. I'm like, okay, what do you want to do? I'm like, blue team? I'm like, okay, can I show you something? And then I show them this. And then that gives them a better idea of where exactly they want to sit. And they can see what sounds interesting. It gives them more tools to enable the start of that journey. Because you may hire somebody that's like, yeah, I went to school for cybersecurity. I don't exactly know what I want to do, but I know I want to do this. And then you get hired for that. And it turns out you really don't like it. And so you're just there doing this thing you don't like. And then your boss is there overseeing you doing this thing that you don't like. And then you're going to leave anyways, which is, you know, like, what? I mean, that's how careers go. You end up moving on. That's just a normal thing. But there are so many things out there to do and learn. And you should always try and reach whatever you think the boundaries of your purview are. Always think outside the box. Like, people think in boxes to walk in lines. Try and stay away from that. Success is not linear. We get conditioned since we're kids to kind of be like good employees. You go to school, wait in line, wait for the bell, do what you're told, stand in line, go up in grades, go up in rank. I think that mentality really stifles out individual entrepreneurial thought in a lot of ways, because you end up thinking that you're not capable of doing something and that you should just stay in your lane. And I'm the analyst, I'm gonna stay here, this is my thing forever. It's like, no, dude, understand the externalities of what you do. Take that ladder approach, lay it flat, and turn into a green field. And then people are more capable of what they think they are. Don't get stuck in the silo. Don't be a one-trick pony, I guess.
Well, I like this domain map. At least you can see, if you have a goal in mind, you can trace it back to an entry point that you can start and at least see a path, which a lot of people want to get in, but they have no idea where to start and where to go or what to even, you know, I just want to get into cybersecurity.
Yeah, it's like if you go to a shooting range, you typically want to know what your target is, right? You don't just want to go in the parking lot and just shoot your gun in the air or shoot where the targets may go. Because that's kind of what it seems like to me. It's like, I want to get into cybersecurity. Okay, you're in the parking lot of a shooting range, shooting at the building itself. Tell me a target. Like, take just a little bit of time to figure that out. I think that domain map makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, I agree. But man, this has been awesome. First time trying a podcast. You agreed to be my first guest. I really appreciate it. I think you've done an outstanding job. So thank you so much.
I appreciate that. That's very kind words. And thanks for having me on. You basically set the bar so high with this first podcast. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to find other people. I'm just kidding. If a buddy's telling me they want to start a podcast, I'm more than happy to help. And it was a good conversation, and I hope people see this and at least can extract value from maybe like one or two things I've said.
But, yeah, you never know who's getting inspired by it, right? All right. Thank you all for watching. Thank you, Mike. Have a good one, man.
All right. My pleasure. All right. Take care. I've lived here for like 15 years, but I'm still not used to the heat. Like, mentally I am. I just know it's a thing, but my body's like, dude, why are you still here? What is
you weren't cut out for this.
Kernos are cold people, man.
Where are you from originally?
Connecticut.
Okay. Yeah. Way up there.
I actually prefer life down here much more, except for when it gets summertime. Like the past couple of years, I've been that bad though.
I'm one of those weird people that loves the heat, and you know, when you go to work and your car's sitting in the baking sun in the parking lot all day and it's time to leave the office and drive home and you get in the car and it's like feels like an oven in there, and most people are like, oh my God, put the windows down, turn the air conditioning on. I'm just like, feels so good in here. Can we just hang out a minute? I think I'm partially a lizard or something.
You actually like that? That's like something that you look forward to?
Yeah, I like it. It feels like a sauna.
It's completely opposite. I will open the door and just stand there and just let the hot air come out for a minute or two. Just like a few moments. Now
I'm like trying to get in fast to trap all the heat inside.